Good evening. I'm Rick Rausch. I'm the Dean of the Melbourne School of Land and Environment, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this international public lecture on climate change, the critical decade, which is part of the 4 degrees or more Australian Hot World Conference that's being held this week. And this is a collaboration between the University of Melbourne and Monash Universities. I begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land in which we sit, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor David Griggs, who will chair this evening. Professor Griggs has a distinguished record in work on climate change, including that in 1996, he was appointed head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Scientific Assessment Unit. In 2001, he became Deputy Chief Scientist and Director of the Hedley Center for Climate Change. And in September 2007, Professor Griggs moved to Australia to become Director of the Monash Sustainability Institute and is also CEO of Climate Works Australia at Monash. David.
Thank you, Rick. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening to chair this session. And it's my first pleasure to introduce our speaker for the evening, Professor Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber, or John Schellenhuber. John has been Director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Change Impact Research, often known as PIC, since he founded that institute in 1991. He's a professor of theoretical physics at Potsdam University and an external professor at the Santa Fe Institute. He's the chairman of the German Advisory Council on Global Change and chair of the unit Climate, Energy and Environment of the Germany Academy of Sciences. He's a member of numerous national and international panels for scientific strategies and policy advice on environment and development matters. For example, the US National Academy of Sciences, the German National Academy of Sciences, and the Max Planck Society. John has served in many capacities on national and international panels for scientific strategies and policy advice. He's been chair of the Global Change Advisory Group for the 6th Framework Programme of the European Commission, a member of the corresponding panel for the Framework 7, a member of the Committee of the Scientific Planning and Review of the International Council for Science, ICSU, a member of the Environment Steering Panel of the European Academy's Science Advisory Council, a member of the World WEF Global Agenda Council on Climate Change, and a member of the Grantham Research Institute Advisory Board. I could go on. As you might expect, he's won several awards in his career. I'm not going to go through them all. I'll just pick out one or two that took my eye from the long list. He was awarded the German Environmental Prize in 2007, the 2008 Order of Merit for the State of Brandenburg in 2008, and in 2004 he was awarded the Commander of the Order of the British Empire by Queen Elizabeth. John is currently Chief Government Advisor on Climate and Related Issues for the German G8 EU Twin Presidency in 2007, a member of the High-Level Expert Group on Energy and Climate Change, advising the President of the European Commission. So as you can see, a very, very distinguished guest. I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to say, and there'll be time for questions at the end. But now, just join me in welcoming Professor Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber.
Now I'm coming from Germany, and in Germany something almost revolutionary is going on. Germany is a well-industrialized country. It came out of the recession, the global financial crisis, much better than probably any other industrialized nation. So we have growth rates of 4% now, things like that, very strong in export. But after Fukushima happened, you know, in Japan, by the way, Fukushima means island of fortune. After Fukushima happened, there has been a U-turn in public perception of nuclear energy. And Germany has decided to completely phase out nuclear power. We have 17 power plants by the year 2022, so in 11 years from now. And nevertheless, in spite of that, honoring our climate protection pledges, namely reducing CO2 emissions by 40%, by the year 2020 as compared to the 1990 levels. If you look at the Australian level of ambition right now, okay, you compare for yourself. But that means, and that is in the end the main message of my talk, we think in Germany right now it's possible to protect the climate, to contribute to climate protection, and at the same time phasing out nuclear, but it's going into an era which we might call the post-fossil nuclear era. And my introductory remarks are about industrial revolutions, actually. Yeah? So before I show you, as my colleague Malte Meinshausen did this afternoon, 160 slides. So be prepared, be brave. Hopefully I can reduce them to 16 or so, or even less. Will depend on your mood. Tell you a little bit about the Industrial Revolution in a sense. Now, I'm writing a book about the climate problem, but in a huge historical context right now. And I was asked by the major, most important German newspaper to write an essay. It was prompted by the Fukushima accident. And I started with a quote from Mahatma Gandhi. I saw that Mahatma Gandhi, there's a very nice citation here in the entrance hall I saw. Mahatma Gandhi was once asked by a British journalist, this man is on the right side, I guess. Yeah, you never know, huh? Okay. So he was asked by a British journalist, "What do you think, Mr. Gandhi, about Western civilization?" And he pondered the question a little while, and then he said, "Well, I think it would be a good idea." Now, Australia is not in the West, but in the South and so on. You don't have to take it seriously. But actually, today we are facing the question, not asked by a journalist, what would you think about global civilization? And the answer is, yes, it would be a good idea. But it hasn't materialized yet. And maybe it will never materialize in a sense that we can eradicate poverty, provide education for everybody, and so on, if we are doing the wrong things in this critical decade. Now, how did Western industrial civilization come about? Well, there have been three factors, and I studied this very seriously over the last 2 years. It was the Enlightenment, clearly, so starting in the late 16th century. It was the emergence, in particular in England, of institutions that guaranteed private property, voting, things like that. So the emergence of democracy in a very mild form. And it was one overwhelming factor that was coal. This is a coal mining country, and I understand the Prime Minister is a coal miner's daughter, maybe, that's what I was told. So coal, in the end, made all the difference why it was not India or China who became the dominating power of the world, but it was England, and it all started in a tiny little part of England, namely Lancashire. So that was the Industrial Revolution, and it was ignited more or less in the year 1785 when a mechanical spinning machine was for the first time combined with a thermodynamical steam-powered machine. It happened in a fabric in Manchester, 1785. It was the day of birth, if you like, or the year of birth of the Industrial Revolution. Now, we certainly need a global industrial revolution for the 21st century if we want to deal with the climate problem, but also with the food problem and many other things. Fossil fuels will run out. We will have coal for a long period of time. We will have methane clathrates on the ocean shelves and so on. But cheap oil, for example, probably has peaked already, and so on and so on. At the same time, as is always in times of prosperity, the same happened in the 18th century, we are getting more and more people on this planet. You can guess if it will be 9 billion in 2050 or 10 billion, whatever. But you know, the double whammy, so to speak, of an increasing population and at the same time the erosion of the boundary conditions that have brought about this population growth. It has happened in history many times, actually. And it is a tremendously dangerous situation. So that's what we're going to face right now, unless we do something which has never been done in history before, because the Industrial Revolution was a self-organized process. I mentioned a few factors which were important, property right, patent right, things like that. And otherwise, it was self-organized by liberal politicians, by community people, by market forces and so on, and it all worked well. But this time, it has to be a process guided by insight, organized over the long term. And that is unprecedented in human history. This is not planning socialism, Stalinism, whatever you call it. It is to be guided by insight. So insight is the most precious resource of the 21st century. Being here at the foremost Australian university, I was told, probably there will be huge protests now, but according to certain rankings, I think it should go down well, but insight is so important. Now, the other thing is, when we talk about long term, we should not just think about ourselves. Now, talking about planning, some of you may have heard the name Marx, but right? Marx, Groucho Marx, who was a great philosopher. And he once said, why should I care for future generations? What have they ever done for me? A wise man, so far for sustainability. Now, the interesting thing really is that when I talked about democracy, for example, we need to extend, transcend, if you like, democracy across time towards future generation. Because the people not born yet, or some already on this planet, but too young to be able to vote, they still need to have a vote in spite of that. So we have to take them into account in our democratic system, which is extremely complicated. So extending democracy across space and time is the big challenge in this context here. Now, since this is an opportunity on this continent to give a lecture and also to ask you questions, not you, me only, maybe I should do a little exercise I've done before, just to find out about the Australian mood here in context of sustainability. Who in the room thinks that you are better off than your grandparents? Please raise your arm. Don't be shy. Peter, I'm disappointed. Okay, I talked him into raising his arm. So it's a good show. And who of you think that your grandchildren will be better off than you are? Please raise your arm. So turn your head. Now, third question, do you think this is okay? So this is a very telling experiment, a social experiment I've done for many times now. And the outcome is the same on all continents, actually, yeah? In spite of cultural differences. It's amazing. So that's the way we view the future. Huh? And so we are in deep trouble, actually, unless we simply ignore the interests of future generations. That means we ignore climate change in the first place. So that brings me, I could stop my lecture now, I guess, but nevertheless, I'd like to torture you a little bit with diagrams, things like that. I've been trained as a physicist and mathematician, so you get not away so easily. But it will not be too bad. Here we go. You know, when people talk about climate change, the so-called skeptics, and some of them are honorable people, of course, who really want to find out what is the scientific truth, but very often they do cherry picking in a sense. You take a curve, a wiggly curve, and when you have a linear fit in whatever segment you like, and when you conclude this is going to be like this over the next 1,000 years or so on, which in general is not true, not in physics, not in climate science. What you should do, rather, is to look at mean values over long periods of time. I think this is a very compelling evidence provided by Columbia University, NASA, namely, how have regional temperatures deviated from the long-term average of the last 4 decades? So if the color turns red or brown, it's getting warmer as compared to the long-term average. Otherwise, if it's going into the blue range, it means it's getting cooler. And so you see the planet is getting more red and finally more brown. So this is a clearly compelling evidence. It does not say anything about whether humankind, technology is involved in any of this. But I think it's a very important thing. If you now do the wiggly line exercise, you know, the black line is the global mean temperature since 1980. The gray range is the IPCC forecast. Actually, the black line is the ensemble average. I have to make it absolutely correct because Dave Griggs, I think you kicked off the ensemble project of the European Union, so the black is an ensemble average. And then we have the measurements, various data sets, Hadley and so on. And you see the line goes up and down. There are even discrepancies between the varying measuring devices and the data consolidation systems and so on. But what you see is that broadly the real development is in the range forecasted by the IPCC. That doesn't mean it will go on like this, for example. And I'd like to contrast it with this one here. This is the curve of global CO2 emissions. And in particular, you see that there was this financial crisis, the economic crisis all over the world, so there was a dip in emissions. The global system has recovered, so to speak, and that means we will have record emissions in 2010, 2011, in particular if you include the latest IEA data, it's probably a 5% increase in emissions. That means steeply the emissions go up when you can measure the CO2 in the atmosphere. It's going up. Nobody's contesting that in any way. The point I'd like to make is that if you go back here, let me see. Of course, you might find here that there is a certain plateau in global mean temperature. 2010 was fairly hot again, but we had a very strong La Nina event, so this year it's going to be cooler again. Of course, you could argue that we have reached a certain level, a certain pause in global warming, and then it will go up again. Again, only when we have the decadal temperatures, we can really make a useful assessment of that. But I should mention that this might have a certain logic. Actually, after my lecture this afternoon, I was asked by somebody, how about volcanoes, you know? A volcano may erupt any time and may undo all type of CO2 emissions and so on. And that's true, clearly. Now, the biggest volcano currently on Earth is the Chinese industry, for many reasons, yeah? But, you know, burning coal, whether it comes from Australia or whether it comes has a lower quality, it's full of sulfur. In China, without filtering system, simply means that a lot of aerosols are put, in particular sulfur particles, are put into the atmosphere. This can create a temporary cooling effect, clearly. We don't know yet whether this is true. But my friend Ramanathan, who is an eminent climate scientist, has been one of the first working on global models, actually. He believes that we currently think we have a warming, a temperature increase on this planet of 0.8 degrees above 1900. So that's not significant, but you can already feel it. Ramanathan thinks that this is masked by the inertia of the ocean, that's one thing, but in particular by aerosols, by the air pollution, the ordinary air pollution, because that reflects sunlight back to outer space. And he thinks the true value, given the CO2 content of the atmosphere currently, is 2.4 degrees Celsius, not Fahrenheit, Celsius. It's only mask. If you lift the veil, if you lift the mask, then within years, months, temperature might catch up again. This has not been solved yet, but we have not really understood what aerosols are doing, but they play a role, and probably they are definitely on the cooling side. So this is one factor which is not a good reason for optimism. I have been involved in the climate negotiations as well, so I was a member of the German delegation in Copenhagen, which was a great experience, not so much for the planet. You know, it was the most chaotic event I ever attended. Has anybody been to Copenhagen here in the room? Oh, yeah, many. So, you know, the Bella Center, you will recall, was built for 15,000 people, but 40,000 people were originally registered, so it couldn't work at all. Copenhagen created nevertheless something which you might think is a turning point in climate diplomacy, namely 2 degrees, a quantitative target for climate protection was acknowledged for the first time. And in Cancun the next year, you have more or less a formal agreement by 194 nations that humankind should try to limit global warming to less than 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial level. Now that is a very, very important thing because, as I can argue, 2 degrees is not a safe level. Below 2 degrees, probably the Great Barrier Reef will perish already. This is one of the most vulnerable ecosystems in the world. I guess Australians are fully aware of that. Not just because of warming, but because of ocean acidification. The combined effect is devastating, definitely. But many other systems can survive if you do not turn up the heat more than 2 degrees. Beyond 2 degrees, large-scale non-linearities will kick in. That means entire organs, if you like, vital organs of the planetary system might collapse. So this may become a fatal accident in the end. I'll talk a little bit about that. But 2 degrees means, for the first time, that we have a yardstick for measuring what climate policy does. Because when in 1992 in Rio, it was the Convention on Climate Change, when it simply said in the famous Article 2, we should do everything to avoid dangerous interference with the climate system. And everybody can define what dangerous means. And the Saudi Arabians, of course, thought it's dangerous to put any barriers to selling oil, which makes a lot of sense for them, actually. Yeah, I mean, I flew in, I should mention it, with Qatar Airlines. So I spent 7 lovely hours on Doha Airport, which is a city just put in the middle of the desert, with skyscrapers, what have you. And they have the highest per capita income in the world. Simply, we are sitting on swampy ground where you can extract gas and oil and everything. Yeah? And you can buy everything in the world for extracting this. Yeah? So that's how it is. But with the 2 degrees target, it is like a speed limit, actually. When people argue and say, why is it not 2.5 and can you scientifically justify it? And I said, well, we scientists have often been asked what is a safe limit, and we say we cannot define it, but we think it's reasonable to have a speed limit for global warming in a certain range. It's like a speed limit in an inner city, yeah, where you have nurseries and hospitals and schools and so on. Nobody would come up with the idea that you have no speed limit there. Right? You can dash along a kindergarten with 150 miles per hour. I think nobody would think this is a good idea. On the other hand, if you would reduce the speed to 10 miles per hour, wouldn't be much fun to drive a car. So we have something in between. So what is the speed limit in Australia? Please tell me, because... okay. So, something like 2 degrees Celsius. Huh? Anyway, so it's important because whenever you have this, when you can just measure whether people have made progress on ensuring that this is being respected. Now, the unfortunate thing that in Copenhagen, it was also agreed upon that the entire climate policy will be an open source, if you like, and bottom-up process, so every nation is invited to submit to the Secretariat whatever they like to. Zero emission reductions, even an increase in emissions, everything is accepted. If you add it all up, we are heading, so that's a paper in Nature, and my colleague Malte Meinshausen was involved. It means that Copenhagen more or less pledged 2 degrees and delivers 4 degrees, 3 to 4 degrees, by the year 2100, that's very important because, and I said this afternoon, if you look beyond 2100, when you see what the real challenge is, if we assume that our physics is correct here, simply means by the year 2100, under the current business as usual scenario, we will have a warming of 3 to 4 degrees, as I just showed you. But the warming goes on if you go beyond 2100. And if we run out of fossil fuels, which will happen at least on the cheaper side anyway, we might end up with a world which is 8 degrees warmer, and it will be so for thousands of years, because it takes 10,000 years or so on to remove 80% of the CO2 from the atmosphere, and part of it will linger on for even longer. The carbon cycle is extremely slow in this context. So it means we are creating a brave new world by doing this. And this is the fundamental choice we have, whether we follow the blue civilization path, if you like, or we follow the brave new world path. Well, of course, some will survive, in particular some microbes, who are used to hot vents and things like that. Well, maybe even some cultures and so on. But it will certainly not support 10 billion people who can live in dignity. And that is the choice we have to make. I talked about 2 degrees already, and actually, I guess that's a bit I skipped most of the things. I promised you 160 slides, so I'll go a little bit quicker. So, Why are we really concerned about global warming? I showed you a few things. Sea level rise, of course, very relevant for Australia. Food production will decline and so on if we go beyond 2 or 3 degrees. But what I am personally most concerned with, because I was trained in particular nonlinear dynamics, so complex systems theory, which is a fairly difficult field of research. You have these ugly partial differential equations with nonlinear terms and so on, only for the specialists here. And only with supercomputers you are able to explore the solution space at all. It's absolutely impossible to solve them by hand. So if you do that and factor in everything, the things you are most concerned with and worried when we heat up the planet is what we call phase transitions in the system, or more popular, in more popular terms, tipping points transgressed. So take the Greenland ice sheet, for example. If, according to the latest modeling exercises we did, if the planet warms up by another 2 degrees, so probably the collapse will start. It can take many centuries, of course, but it will be irreversible. And that means adding 7 meters to sea level alone, just from Greenland. Another very interesting thing, which I didn't mention this afternoon, is I'm very much involved in a study, is so-called ENSO phenomenon. Now, you probably know about it here in Australia, El Niño, Southern Oscillation. So it's linked to the monsoon system, of course. When the Earth started its glaciation, deglaciation, roller coaster dynamics 2.5 million years ago, scientists now think it was because a permanent El Niño ended then. The permanent El Niño before, it's one of the hypotheses, kept the world warm enough in order to avoid major glaciations, the building of the big ice sheets on the northern hemisphere. Now, just imagine what would happen if we would go into a permanent El Niño state in addition to the warming which is in the system already. So an enhanced greenhouse effect plus a permanent El Niño. That would create something like a runaway greenhouse effect, in a sense that we would skip an entire temperature range and stabilize at an even higher level. Now, these things have not been proven. Actually, only very few people look into these matters. And that is, I think, all the people who have authority in a leading university know that research is not, research money is not directed in general to the most exciting, let alone the most relevant topics, but to the most rewarding topics, where you can increase your citation index and so on. It's like that. You have to make a career, even if you are a scientist. So very few people look at the things which are really interesting. But if you are in the neighborhood of where the light already is, it's much easier to find something and to make a career. So this whole issue of runaway greenhouse dynamics, and it happened in this universe before, namely on Venus, which has a surface temperature of 440 degrees centigrade, although because of albedo effects, it receives less sunshine than the Earth now. So that's the CO2. So looking into runaway dynamics and so on, very few people do that. Greenland, I talked about it already. Let me just turn to two major time bombs, if you like. You know, a tipping event means you have a very small perturbation and you tip a relevant system into a different mode of operation. But people always think this is an abrupt thing. It doesn't have to be abrupt at all. Now, we have two big elements in the Earth system. One is the carbon stored in the permafrost soils. It is about, according to the latest estimates, it's 0.5 trillion tons. That is about twice as much carbon as contained in the entire atmosphere. That is slumbering, frozen in the soils of Siberia and Alaska and so on. Now, it's a very simple physical process which is jeopardizing that that carbon store, it's simply thawing, which happens above 0 degrees centigrade. So don't have to be a genius to understand that. Of course, it's much more complicated to estimate how quickly the thawing will propagate through the system and so on. But nevertheless, this is a huge time bomb. And the other one is methane hydrates, clathrates, on the continental shelves, in shallow ocean water and so on, which is the biggest source of fossil energy in the world, by far exceeding all the coal we have and so on. If we could tap it in a reasonable way, there would be no energy problems whatsoever for humanity, of course, and if we would not burn it into releasing CO2 again, clearly. Methane emanations have happened in the Earth history and have probably caused major extinction events as well. Now, when I organized for the National Academy of Science of the US a special feature on tipping points in the Earth system and so on, I asked groups to submit a paper on methane hydrates and how we could be mobilized through global warming. And there was just one group in the world who dared to do a quantitative assessment, David Archer and colleagues. And what he found is, yes, it is a possibility, but it will be an extremely slow tipping point. That means you tip the system, you administer the right type of perturbation, but it will take 1,000 years until this reservoir will be emptied. But once you have started it, there's nothing to do against it. So can you imagine, you just tip the system, and then you have to watch for 1,000 years how it evaporates and adds 2 or 3 degrees warming on top of what we have already in store. Now, these are extremely exciting issues for a scientist. On the other hand, they are also deeply worrying. And there's almost no research done on that. And it's amazing. Maybe I should tell you also that, you know, I have studied the history of the discovery of global warming also. Now, Svante Arrhenius, the Nobel laureate in chemistry from Sweden, before the end of the 19th century, published several papers with monumental calculations he did by hand on the greenhouse effect, and came up with almost the right range of warming if you double CO2 in the atmosphere. And when another colleague of his, a certain Ångström, not the famous Ångström, but his son, did just one lab experiment. I have to say it was carried out by a German. I apologize for that, because it was probably the worst experiment ever done in the world. And he did just 2 measurements, and based on that, Arrhenius' theory was completely ignored, actually, for 50 years. So for 50 years, nothing happened on that frontier, although he was on the right track already. And only after the Second World War, actually beginning with the Second World War, but in particular after the Second World War, the US military started to pile up in the data stores measurements of infrared radiation transfer in the upper atmosphere, but also in entire atmosphere. Why? Because we needed a better control of steering their B-52 bomber fleets. That was the beginning of real climate science, actually. Because when you revisited all the data, you found out that, yes, Arrhenius was right and Ångström was dead wrong about this. So 50 years were lost in science, and 50 years since this 1958 movie were lost in policy making, because really nothing has happened in order to reduce emissions. Now, this is a figure I'd like to show you. Today, in spite of all the complexities of the climate system, we can calculate that the mean global temperature rise we will produce over the next 40 or 50 years is just a function, a very simple linear function, of the accumulated emissions of CO2. So if you tell me how much emissions will happen over the next X years, so to speak, I can calculate what the global mean temperature rise will be with an order of 10% of error, of something like that. It's good enough, definitely. If we want to hold the 2 degrees line I spoke about, which has been internationally confirmed and so on, we have about 750 gigatons of carbon dioxide to spend till the middle of the century. Every year we add more than 30, so you can calculate it would only work for another 20 years and so on. But the really interesting story is the following. That's why my lecture has the title The Critical Decade. If we have 750 gigatons to spend in order to hold the 2 degrees line with a certain probability, not a good one, but at least an acceptable one, then yeah, we have to distribute that over time. So that's the one thing. So here are three scenarios how it could be spent. The area under the curve is always the same, the integral. And what you see in particular, if we wait till the year 2020 to peak global emissions, including China, India, everybody, we would have to reduce afterwards according to the red curve. That means 9% reduction per year. And we would have to phase out CO2 completely by 2040. Now, this is all basic science. So there's no political row about it. The question is whether we want to do it or not. Okay, I go to the last section because, let me see. So you don't see, oh, by the way, I should show you this at least. Who are the biggest per capita polluters in the world? It's not Australia, it is Qatar. So talking about Doha Airport and so on, it's more than 40 tons CO2 per capita. It's also the richest country in the world per capita, so to speak. So there seems to be a link here. Anyway, so let me go to the last thing. So Peter Doherty is here, and I mentioned already this Nobel Laureates meeting. We met in 2009, the invitation, and again, you know, the Queen of England had her hand in it. We met in St. James Palace. Prince Charles was organizing it, attended and so on. So clearly there is a conspiration here pointing to England. And at that time, actually 60 Nobel laureates, including the Dalai Lama, Mikhail Gorbachev and others, have signed this declaration in a sense. We need something like, yes, first of all, we have to have a peak of global emissions by 2015. Seems completely out of reach, but that is what is inferred from the physics. We need a total carbon budget to consider. And of course, we need, in order to bring this about, a great transformation on industrial revolution, which is absolutely unprecedented. And I will end with a little animation on this industrial revolution, so to speak. It goes like this. Okay, the world according to John Schellenhuber. Now, it's the world according to the economist, first of all. Now, if you talk to economists, we in general have this paradigm of convexity. Convexity means you have an overall cost function, you know. You have some space. This is maybe the share of fossil fuels in the energy mix. So you would be completely renewable here, and here you are, and here you are completely fossil or whatever, or here. And this is a cost function simply, and you try to minimize the costs, of course. So the output is good standard of living, but at the lowest possible cost. That's the paradigm of the economist. And if the world is like this, there's just one global minimum here, and we sit in this global minimum. And if we want to move away from that, whether to the left or to the right, the forces of the market will drive us back to this global minimum. So everything is perfect. Now, if you factor in the so-called externalities, and many modern economists do that, so global warming is one of these external factors. So if you unleash the forces and capacities of science, and I include just for a minute the economics in the sciences, then you do a recalculation. What are the real costs if you factor in future generation side effects, you know, respiratory diseases and many other things of fossil fuel burning. So the costs go up, clearly. But the really interesting thing is that science tells you there is an alternative to that. So we have our radar waves, so to speak, and we find that at least we have a multi-equilibrium landscape. This is actually, if you go towards renewables and energy efficiency, there's a much deeper minimum, a real global optimum there. And every potential analysis tells you it is like that. Just think of Australia. You're sitting in a deep, deep fossil hole. As the Americans say, if you are in a deep hole, stop digging. But of course, you want to go on with digging, yeah? And many jobs depend on that. It's fully understandable, clearly. Yeah? But the alternative would be to use all types of technology, innovation, investment, and so on, to move into a renewable Australia. Of course, it could be a contribution to saving the climate, but it would in particular save your competitiveness over the centuries to come. It would be a sustainable solution. Huh? And you have so much sunshine. I mean, in Germany, we set up all these solar panels where the sun is shining maybe only 100 days a year and so on. Huh? Nevertheless, it works. You can use diffusive light and so on. With ingenuity of engineers and so on, you can do it. But for Australia, it would be a very simple option, actually. But you have to have a lot of upfront investments. And in particular, there is a hill, some people say even a mountain range, separating the local optimum we are sitting in, I'm almost done, from the global optimum here. So how do we get across that hill? Now, the current policy in general works because you have so many lobbyists, of course, and again, it's absolutely human. You're making a living. You would like to be even better off. So the current system works in a sense, but you deepen the hole by subsidies, for example, for fossil fuels. And you heighten the barriers, for example, by barriers to global cooperation, dissemination of new technologies, patents, and so on. So the hole looks even deeper than it is. What we would have to do is flatten the hole, for example, a price on carbon, that may sound so familiar to you, if it's only a small amount, actually, and through investing heavily into science and technology, you can make the hill much flatter. And when you only need Brownian motion, so to speak, you need a haphazard event like Fukushima or whatever, and when this is, and this is what will happen. So we have to push the system into the real global optimum. But the preconditions for that are removing perverse subsidies, put a price on carbon, and invest heavily into the knowledge industry. Okay, Germany has actually done right that, and we have embarked now. The crossover will be, you know, this is our current energy mix, so we have 22% coming from nuclear energy, electricity, 16.5% from renewables, and the idea is that this crossover year will be in 2 years from now, and when we go along this path of renewable. And this under not favorable conditions, actually. Of course, there's wind energy in the end. Okay, I would like to end, and you have sneak preview already, on a sort of, what is it? Irony should never be used with children and politicians. But I can use it here, actually. Now, this is the cozy side of climate change. You know, the North Pole population and the South Pole population finally united through global warming. It's too cozy for me, I have to confess. Thank you very much.
was such an enlightening talk. Given our late start, I beg the audience's indulgence to have some questions, perhaps 10 minutes of questions at the end. So we'll start here with the person in the front. Wait for there are microphones coming, so please wait for the microphones. And can I ask that, given that we have such little time, please don't make statements. Do ask questions and try and keep your questions very short.
And I will not make any comments on the Queen of England, I promise.
Thanks, Professor Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber, for a fantastic talk. It's much appreciated. I'm wondering, given the situation in Australia, there seems to be a move, an agenda to move Australia from coal to gas, and by building 60 years of gas infrastructure and then to renewables. Is there time for us to build an entire gas fossil fuel infrastructure on the way to building a renewable energy future?
That's a very important question, actually, because in Germany right now, we are pondering that question, what role natural gas might play in the transition period, so to speak. Because the idea before Fukushima was always, well, nuclear energy will be the bridge towards the renewables, so the bridge will hold for 20 years and so on, and then we will all be fine. And now this bridge has been burnt, more or less. And so, of course, natural gas can be factored in. We did some calculations on that. If you use the highest level of efficiency, very modern systems, natural gas would reduce your CO2 emissions by about 50% as compared to lignite and so on, or even more. So yes, it can be factored in if it's seen as a transition thing. But I should say also, and that is something which is still hotly debated in Germany, I think it was an issue here, but not so much, is the only way to use fossil fuels over the decades to come would be if you combine it with carbon capture and storage, which is very unpopular, no, because you put something underground, it may come back, but otherwise you put it directly into the atmosphere, which is not much better, I guess, or even worse. So if you would use natural gas-fired power stations and you would hopefully combine it with carbon capture and sequestration, that would be the best option of all, actually. But the interesting thing is that with new techniques of drilling and so on, which can be very environmental damaging, of course, but the whole thing has just started, you have plentiful of natural gas in many countries. So they even start drilling again in Germany. So it's an interesting option, but in the long run, I would say we probably cannot solve the climate problem nowhere in the world if we have not one way, do not find a large-scale scheme to sequester carbon from emissions, but probably even from the atmosphere right now. Negative emissions, so to speak. And I think CCS would be a good laboratory for exploring that. I mean, my favorite option would be you go to large amounts of biomass energy, so to speak, reforestation of degraded land. You use the biomass, which is also a storage medium for energy. That's the major advantage of biomass, of course. Take the energy out, you sequester the carbon, you can even fertilize fields with it. And that would create, in addition to having energy, it would create a huge carbon sink on this planet. So biosequestration in the end and gas. I gave you many answers you didn't ask for, but...
So do you have no optimism that renewable energy can do the job? Do you have no optimism?
Biomass would be a renewable energy, clearly. I mean, this is carbon neutral completely. I think that renewable energies, after a few decades in some countries who are willing to embark on that road, will do the job. But I think that natural gas is the best transition option, and if you combine it with CCS, it's even carbon neutral.
Okay, more questions? It's a question here on the side here, and then there's one right up on the back row we'll go to next. Right up on the back row on the left we'll go next, but we'll start down here.
You speak a lot about nuclear energy in somewhat of a negative light, and I'm just interested to know if you ignored, if you ignored the fear of nuclear warfare, I'm interested to know what your thoughts are on nuclear energy in terms of a more environmental solution.
Okay. I mean, you give me another hour? I mean, the nuclear problem is manifold, clearly. I think in the end, what will kill the nuclear industry everywhere in the world is simply the economic costs. Because if you look at what it really costs to set up a power plant, if you would factor in insurance, rebuilding it, dismantling it, storing and so on, if you would internalize all the externalities, it's just too expensive. On top of that, we have proliferation and so on. But you are right. I mean, we have still, 10,000 nuclear warheads slumbering somewhere.
22,300 in the world.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, so I try to be conservative here. And this is a shame, clearly, because it's true. You run with sort of nuclear reactors for producing energy, and you do everything that way will not explode. And you have these huge stockpiles of nuclear arms, which are meant to explode, of course. So it's completely crazy. We just have forgotten about it since the Cold War came to an end and the Berlin Wall came down. It is a big problem. Actually, we did a study recently at the Pontifical Academy about the nuclear winter caused by an exchange of weapons, if it would have happened in the Cold War, turned into a hot war. And it has a huge impact on the climate as well. But probably there wouldn't be many around to enjoy the new climate.
Okay, right up in the back corner. And then we'll come down to halfway down on this side.
Thanks, Hans. Dr. Schillenhuber. I was wondering if you could perhaps go back to a couple of the slides that you skipped and talk about them a bit more. They're the ones that you've got the budgets for the different countries, which changes quite a bit depending on the level of per capita emissions.
Yeah, let me see if I can.
I guess how that relates to Australia and perhaps to with the previous question about how moving to low fuels versus zero emission fuels would affect a country like Australia. So I think the next slide where you show a 10-year decarbonisation timeline for the USA, would be similar for a country like
you're
Australia.
Right. Very smart, thank you, because I was just wondering, Australia is not on the chart, but Australia is very similar to the US, as you can see. You're competing for rank number 8 or 7 in the world with the US, and that means, yes, what would be the decarbonization trajectory for Australia if we want to hold the 2 degrees line, and that has been decided by the United Nations, so it must be true. And second, if we just accept the physics, which I showed you, where is this quasi-linear relationship between the cumulative emissions and the global warming, and then it would mean if we would distribute the carbon allowances just according to the population size, which means every person in the world has the same right to pollute or to use the atmosphere, then that would be Australia's trajectory, which is, of course, impossible, clearly. So that's why, and that is important, so thanks for prompting this answer. We think that countries can go ahead on a national basis when it comes to innovation, new technology, energy efficiency. But the remaining carbon budget has to be spent globally, clearly. Without a global agreement, it's impossible. So what would mean there are many countries in the world, like here, India. India has a population of 1.2 billion. Minister Ramesh told me we expect to end with 1.6 billion in 20 years from now. Not necessarily end, we will reach 1.6 billion. So we, in a sense, have plenty of carbon space left. And we could just sell it to a country like Australia. And yeah, that sounds, I don't know, but you know, the industrialized countries, I talked about coal and the Industrial Revolution, have polluted the atmosphere for free for many, many years. Why not being at least equitable in the future? The Brazilians would tell you, you have to take into account even the historical emissions. Huh? Now, this is certainly not politically feasible, but creating a global carbon market where you can sort of soften some of the hardships which would come along with that scheme, I think that's perfectly sensible. And actually, if you calculate what it would mean, it's just a transfer of about $100 billion, US dollars in this case, per year from north to south. I mean, it's not much if you divide it by the GDP and so on. Huh? So, yes, the problem can be solved, but it's not a free lunch. And I understand, not even in Australia, there is a free lunch. Or perhaps there is.
We're going to have to make this next question the last question, mm-hmm. because we're already 10 minutes over time.
I had one question. I now have two as a result of that. Very quickly, is the per capita average, global average, got to come down to about 2 or 3? Is that your understanding?
Yeah. No. Actually, it's interesting. We have to, the average by 2050 has to be around 2 tons of CO2. But if you integrate over time, the average, it's about 2.8 or something. So that is the yardstick for everybody, in a sense. So China is already beyond that. But India is below that. So you have to really honor that something has to happen fairly soon about all this. And Chancellor Merkel, so our prime minister, if you like, she's a physicist by training. I have the pleasure of advising her on some issues. She even understands what a PDF is. Probability density function and so on. Oh, that helps. As you can imagine, she has just renewed this thing. So your question is very appropriate. There was an intermediate climate summit in Berlin just the other week, last week actually, where 30 or something environment ministers came, and she gave a speech where she said, yes, 2 degrees. It has to be considered as a global budget, and by 2050, we all have to converge to two tons per capita, more or less. Whether this will ever come true, I don't know, but it's the yardstick. And if you ignore the physics, if you ignore equity, if you ignore all principles of fairness, then, of course, we can forget about all this and just go home and pollute as we did before. But if we face the truth of natural sciences and we think if there is a global solution, it should be equitable in some way, fair according to certain standards, when this is the way forward, I apologize for that.
I think that's an excellent place to call a halt to proceedings. Okay, so it just calls on me to ask Rick Rausch to give the vote of thanks.
Don't go away. Actually, Professor, one of my favorite philosophers Groucho Marx is one of my favorite philosophers. And one of the other things he said is he'd never join a club that would have him as a member.
Oh, right.
But I think tonight, Professor Schellnhuber has illustrated that there is a club that we'd all like to be members of, and that's one that looks at a rational discourse about the kinds of data that you've presented. And the other thing I want to comment on is Professor Schellnhuber mentioned that he won't be able to stay very long in Australia, so it's appropriate that we give him a symbolic taste of Australia. And the organizers wouldn't have known this, but this is a particularly good symbol, because as my colleague Snow Barlow has observed, there are very few, if any, skeptics about climate change in the wine industry because they can all see their harvest dates moving inexorably earlier and earlier. So with that, I'd like to offer you a little bit of taste for Australia. I'm sure you'll be able to. It's a Tal-Tarni Pyrenees Victoria Shiraz 2007.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's a good drop.
Okay, thank you very much.